Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny. This week, A.K. Benjamin on a story of unravelling minds in his book, Let Me Not Be Mad. A.K. Benjamin is a clinical neuropsychologist specialising in diagnostics and acute rehab. Previously, he was a screenwriter, spent 2 years as a contemplative monk, and has worked at a number of NGOs with homeless addicts, with gangs, and with children with acquired and congenital neurological conditions. He no longer lives in the UK, and also A.K. Benjamin is not his real name. And today we're going to be talking about his book, Let Me Not Be Mad, A Story of Unravelling Minds. So, person, go by the name of A.K. Benjamin. Welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much.
What's the idea behind the book?
Well, I suppose there wasn't one single idea. First of all, I was struck by how inauthentic case studies are often when they're written up. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of invisible and unconscious conventions that seem to control the way that they're written. And yet they purport to want to describe something that's actually going on in the room between a clinician and the patient. And just from my own experience, whenever I'm in the room and there's a patient there, it's always a lot more chaotic and messy than the case studies that I would read about. So there was some attempt to capture some of that mess. That was part of it. And then along with that, there was also a wish to use that starting place of case studies and engage the reader in a particular set of conventions and then start to dissolve those conventions and use a contract, which is not unlike the contract between a doctor and a patient, to start smuggling in different kinds of treatment and different kinds of medicine, different kinds of narcotics into that. And then the third thing, I think, was that I just needed, as a sometime patient, to get something off my chest with me forcing myself to be doctor to my own patient. So they were three of the impetuses behind it.
So, as you said, I mean, the book sort of appears to be a medical practitioner's memoir of case studies of patients, and we've had plenty of that sort of thing on Little Atoms before, but it goes off in a very different direction, which I don't really want to go too far into because a lot of the pleasures of the book are discovering that for yourself. And as you've just mentioned also, it's a memoir of your own treatment for illness as well. And so, again, I mean, you've just sort of touched on this, but a lot of those medical memoirs will obviously be talking about patients, and there is patient and doctor confidentiality. And there's a number of levels which you play with that here. First of all, obviously, you've, changed the names, changed events and times, slightly fictionalized in some ways, or mixed up the patients. But also, first of all, there's a pseudonym on the front of the book. And also, as you've said, there's, again, what we can't really talk about, but what happens with your own treatment as it's threaded through the book. So let's talk about some of those ideas about writing about, there's the trust between a patient and a doctor. When the patient is seeing the doctor, they're not expecting to end up in a best-selling medical memoir years down the line.
And that was something that I agonised about. And even though As you say, there's no single patient that's represented in the book. It's an amalgam of certain clinical encounters and certain things that were fabricated to look like clinical encounters. That said, there felt something transgressive just about entering that territory, and that was one of the two main factors that made me want to change the name. The other factor being that because the book becomes deeply personal, there was a wish to protect family members and friends from some of the material that I used. You know, so.
And well, let's talk about how did you end up in the field in the first place?
So, I ended up being a monk on the west coast of America for 2 or 3 years. And something that, which in itself is a story, but I'd signed up very knowingly and thought about it carefully. And it meant relinquishing a number of things. And for a couple of years, the life of a contemplative monk, so a life of a lot of solitude and silence, was very restorative and beautiful in lots of ways. But I started to get itchy feet. And the monks, being sort of liberal and psychologically minded, allowed me to engage in more active pursuits. So they would give me little secondments from the monastery, and I found myself going into Central America and doing some work there, and then up into Northern California and doing some work there with different populations. I had some experience of running an NGO with homelessness and addiction and psychiatric problems. So as I started to do this and combine it with being a monk, it became clear to me that I lacked certain professional qualifications. So I went to see a very wise lady, and she was in her early 80s, and she had trained in psychiatry when she was in her 60s, having had a number of different careers. And she was very desperate about the state of psychiatry. And like me, her initial interest had been in literature. My first degrees were in literature and philosophy, and she sort of petitioned me to make use of my background and to train in the field of mental health, but to bring a different kind of anthropology and a different series of interests to the practice of psychology or psychiatry. So something that was broader than a narrowly medical anthropology. So I basically took her at her word and decided to leave the monastery after a couple of years and began a 12-year training in clinical neuropsychology.
Now, a lot of medicine, even today, is, as you describe your field in the book, often more art than science. And anything to do with the brain and the mind is, you know, probably even more so. What are some of the, even today with, you know, the neuroimaging that we have, you know, the great advances, it's still, you know, a lot of times misdiagnoses happen and things, and, you know, it's still, you know, not 100%. What are some of the issues, particularly around this field?
Well, if you take imaging as a starting point, and this is something that we go into a little bit in the book, that especially in the early stages of neurological conditions, scans can be very ambiguous and depend upon corroborating the scans with symptoms. But then the symptoms for various conditions overlap. And so reliability and validity for diagnosis using scans in the early stages of neurology can be fraught. That's neurology. In psychiatry, there is almost no valid and reliable markers for psychiatric conditions. The attempt, which is a sort of has got a tradition to make psychiatry a biological medicine and find underpinnings for the diagnoses that we're all familiar with in terms of neuroanatomical markers, has not proved very, very successful at all. So, I mean, that leads to the question, is the problem then with the markers themselves, or is it with the quality of the imaging and the way that imaging itself is a sort of a series of displacements, a kind of platonic cave of echoes? And I think most people would say, well, the imaging gets better and stronger, but the reliability of the diagnoses does not improve when it comes to identifying psychiatric diagnoses. So that's some of the fraughtness around those areas.
And what about the sort of the history of the field itself? In that, you know, you mentioned in the book the idea of like measuring schools in the past.
I see. Yeah. So neuropsychology itself is relatively new. There have been attempts to measure things like intelligence for at least 100 years, and of course, even when they are declared as scientific, they historically have been informed by all sorts of different ideological slants. Like in the 19th century in particular, there was an attempt to prove that Caucasians were more intelligent than other races, and all sorts of natty and elaborate ways were sought to reinforce this by measuring the skulls in different ways to support the existing prejudice. Of course, that didn't pan out to be the case. Although there even now there exists some neuroscientific pockets that I think Sam Harris is still interested, for example, in neuroanatomical markers of race and ideology.
You also talk in the book about how suggestible people are and how easy it is for the doctor. There's experiments that you talk about where how easy it is for a clinician to make a patient believe they're experiencing things that they're not necessarily.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating territory, and it's really under researched, the whole notion of suggestibility, but also what is implied about suggestibility. And there seems to be an a priori thing which suggests that we're suggestible because we don't really know what we're on about in the first place. When I tell you the most intimate things about myself, I've not really thought them through. So as soon as they're out there, they're somehow detached from me and therefore manipulable by you, particularly if there's a power gradient between you and me, as there is in a doctor and a patient thing. So you can take something that I didn't say, tell me that I said it. For example, you can say, oh, you look a bit anxious. I didn't know that I was anxious, but I look anxious. And then you can start to help me elaborate this non-existent anxiety by asking me, oh, have I been as anxious as this before? And yes, by God, I have been as anxious as this before. In fact, I'm going to take myself now through my memory back to that time, and my heart rate will start to increase. And you can then start to tell me, together we can draw a little story about my history of anxiety, and sooner or later I may or may not have to run out of the room screaming.
And so, I mean, again, if I come to see you and say, you know, I think I've broken my leg, it's like quite easy enough to diagnose whether or not I've broken my leg or not. Let's talk about what happens if I come to your clinic and say, you know, I've started losing my memory slightly. I've started, you know, misnaming things, easy and obvious things, or forgetting obvious names. Where do we go from there?
Well, first of all, we'll chat about it for half an hour or so. And I will use sort of basically my clinical intuition, knowing that, first of all, everyone thinks their memory's going anyway. Secondly, everyone's memory is going after the age of about 28, but people tend not to notice it substantively until, you know, till say the late 30s when they're having to write things down. So normal age in memory deterioration. What we're looking for is something over and above normal deterioration, and there are types of hallmark signs for that, but then they're refracted through what sort of personality you have. So are you the sort of person that notices those things? And then if you do notice them, are you worrying about them? So there's a sort of dance between, you know, going back to that notion that it's not all science. There's artfulness involved. Then I'm trying to get a sense of who you are, what the hard signs of your claimed memory loss are. Have other people noticed it? Usually we'd want a collateral informant, like a spouse or a son or a daughter in there to give a third perspective, although those perspectives themselves may well be loaded by and framed by the relationship between the informant and the person that's in front of you, so they themselves aren't hard evidence. So, but anyway, once we've sort of drawn a sketch of what your memory looks like, I'll start to use then instruments, well-validated tests for different forms of memory performance. And I'll get you to perform, and I'll measure that performance against what I would expect someone of your ilk, using relatively crass demographic coordinates, to compare your performance with other people like you. And in that way, I'll have some vague idea of whether your memory, especially if it's early in the stage of a neurodegenerative process, I'll have some idea of whether your memory is changing. And if it is, and then that's correlated with other neurological markers, like a scan, then we may be able to get you on a neurodegenerative retardant quicker than if we have to wait until we find you lost in a park with your trousers around your ankles.
And I mentioned earlier, you know, the danger of misdiagnosis. And indeed, early on in the book, there's a chapter about a woman here called Lucy, where there's a misdiagnosis. But more specifically in that chapter, you also talk about how this happened to you too.
Yeah, I did. I had a sort of, how do I describe it? I suppose a brief psychotic break that was brought on by acute stress when I was in my 20s. Acute stress, and it was at a time where I was abusing drugs and alcohol. And I was referred to a psychiatrist. I went to see the psychiatrist, and I was in a state. I was very paranoid about the psychiatrist, and we didn't click at all. And he wrote a letter on the basis of the assessment that intimated that I had a particular diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, which is a very extreme and shocking diagnosis to receive. In fact, at the time, it was in the north of England, and at the time, this particular doctor was known for, first of all, was known for that, for giving that diagnosis, and secondly, that diagnosis itself had proliferated massively because there was, I think broadly social and political reasons, there were a number of homeless people, homeless addicts on the streets, on the city streets, and the conferring of this diagnosis enabled people to be removed from the streets into different kind of treatment centres, and so it had a functionality. Anyway, I was referred on to see a psychotherapist who, after about three or four therapeutic sessions with me, was very dismissive about this psychiatric diagnosis. And I worked with him. It was a very important time in my life. It was the first time I'd been in psychotherapy, and it had a very healing effect. And yet, just that utterance of borderline personality disorder has meant that whenever things become difficult or sticky, then I feel the sort of ghost of it knocking around. It's been difficult to fully undo its power. So if it was a misdiagnosis, it's something that still managed to shape aspects of my experience of myself and of the world, even though it probably took this guy not very long to stick it down in his assessment letter.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Listen to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today we're talking about Let Me Not Be Mad, a story of unravelling minds by A.K. Benjamin. And, well, we're going to stick with you. So you're now, you know, you're working as a clinical neuropsychologist. and, you know, you're surrounded by, you know, people with illness all the time, you have a family, and you start to get ill again. And I want to talk about how that manifested itself at this time.
First of all, the events that I describe in the book are not the events that happened to me. I'm just going to detour a little bit here. I started writing a journal at the time that I was having difficulty at work, and then I went on to leave work and carried on with this journal. But I got very bored with just documenting internal states. It didn't seem to have any therapeutic benefit to me after a brief while. The confessional element seemed bogus. What I started to do was start arranging like fragments of real experience in different ways, and introducing things that didn't happen to me, and then amalgamating them, and that way a sort of story grew out of them, and that became the second half of the book was more like that. But for me as a clinician, I think if I was to formulate what was happening to me myself in a sort of semi-professional way, I'd say, well, first of all, my idea for being a clinical neuropsychologist was someone else's idea that they put into me. So it hadn't been, even though it was very compelling and interesting to me, it wasn't my idea, and I didn't actually own it very fully. I jumped through all these hoops, you know, there was something like 4 different degrees that I had to do, and just by a sort of force of will, and hadn't really thought through what it was going to be like to work in the NHS with neurologists and neurosurgeons, and how, you know, I hadn't had a regular job before that. I'd done various different things which afforded me quite a lot of freedom and allowed me to be myself in ways that I couldn't quite be. So there was a sense at that level that I felt a bit more and more caged. Another thing that happened was, I just remember this very clearly, and this was the moment that I start the book with. There was a woman in front of me, and she was probably the 2,000th woman I'd ever seen for an assessment. And she was about my age, and she had some pretty hideous tumours. And I'm doing my assessment, and I'm writing down the normal questions, eye colour and left or right-handed, and just doing a sort of general holistic assessment. And suddenly the scales fall from my eyes, and I start hearing her suffering as though the 1,999 people before her had all just appeared now in this woman, and the partition was gone. And I felt incredibly moved by this woman in a way I couldn't remember having felt. And rather than wanting to be an expert and make some clever diagnosis, I just wanted to give her a hug. And then more than that, I wanted to take her home and look after her. And of course, that's not something you can do. And there was this profound sense of loss and frustration that came through. And it started there. And then it developed. I couldn't get past that feeling of wanting to break the boundaries down. And of course, some of this has got nothing to do with my empathic capacities as a doctor, and has got more to do with the fact that I myself was struggling to keep my head above water, in a big city faced by the breakup of a relationship and being separated from children, financial insecurity, etc., stuff that everyone's navigating, but some people are more resilient than others. So that was the start of my unravelling.
Well, of course, it would be an obvious question to say, or what difference does being a clinical neuropsychologist make when you're becoming ill yourself? But of course, that's a ridiculous question, because it was doing that job that's making you ill in the first place.
I wouldn't say that it's making me ill, but there was something about my the misalignment between me and the profession, or at least the way that the profession's practiced in the place that I was working. But on the other side of it, I did, before I was a neuropsychologist, I did a doctorate in clinical psychology. So I've done quite a lot of talking therapy with people, and I know certain strategies. And in the end, some of those strategies have been very helpful. And my instincts, I think, because of the training that I've received, have been more towards being able to look after myself well, and hopefully, you know, friends and family well, as a result of the training I've had. Although that's not always the case.
Well, what then was it like? I want to ask about being on the other side of the desk, so being treated by other clinicians, perhaps even colleagues.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole thing in psychotherapy that the modality of psychotherapy itself isn't so important. It's the therapeutic alliance. And I don't know if that's true, but I certainly know what it's like to be trying to work with someone where there's a terrible disjunction between you and that other person because of a personality clash. I had a very, very difficult time surrendering my own sense of what should be going on to a therapist if I don't trust them. Or, you know, for example, I'm, for want of a better word, I'm quite childish, youthful, playful, whimsical, and I was stuck in a room with someone that was deadly serious for 3 months. Now, I'm always going to feel like more of an imbecile around someone like that. But since then, I've met therapists that don't feel the need or don't express themselves in that way, and I found it easier to get on with that type. So I think there's something about the alchemy at the level of personality between you and the other person. But you've also, just because I know something, I've got to have faith in their expertise, you know. That can be very hard once you've been an expert yourself.
I mean, in some respects, you also know that often that expertise is based on quite shaky foundations.
Shaky foundations, yeah. You've got to give yourself a bit of a head injury in order to buy into the expertise of people in the first place. You've got to undergo a kind of amnesia, which is a form of faith, in order to really to start trusting, especially if you're working a little psychodynamically with someone where the relationship is crucial to the process of relearning how to regulate difficult emotions and experiences.
What happened next? How do you get back to sort of where you are now there?
Yeah, for me it was a fairly radical intervention about changing my job, changing my country, finding a therapist that I got on really well with, and then just allowing by creating some space, by creating an entirely different environment, just allowing life then to teach me certain lessons that I'd just been utterly unable to receive, either unable or just too contracted because of the pressures of working and living in the way I had been. So there was no single magical bullet. I certainly benefited from meditation practice. That's one thing that, even though I find it very difficult dispositionally to sit still, you know, for more than 5 minutes, I guess it's been 4 or 5 years now of daily meditation. That seems to be one thing that has definitely helped move things on. But there have been many other things as well, and some of them that don't look at all like formal interventions, you know, just like, for example, playing cricket again, or I don't know, becoming a bit more vegetarian. A number of small things like that.
And just one more thing then. I just want to talk about the process of writing the book and I guess what the point of it is. Who do you want to read this book?
I mentioned a bit about the process already, just that you know, it had gone from journaling to a different kind of imaginative enterprise. And I think the most exciting thing for me as a reader these days tends to be reading nonfiction where the writer uses the contract of nonfiction to start doing imaginative sleights of hand in order not to con, but to try and expand our notion of reality. And that was the most important thing, that I could use something that had the spine of truth in it and use a sense of the reader's expectations of that to start removing certainties in different ways, and with the hope that the effect of that, the cumulative effect of that, would be to give a more urgent rendition of the reality I was trying to convey in the first place. So, I suppose, what sort of reader? Well, a reader that would be interested in that as a process, a reader that feels themselves to be mad, a reader that doesn't trust the doctors but also loves the medical profession for what they do. Yeah, so someone who likes things intense, which is most people when it comes to reading experiences.
So we've been talking about Let Me Not Be Mad, A Story of Unravelling Minds by A.K. Benjamin. And thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with me.
Thank you very much for having me.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89 Up, and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.